Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in. Welcome to Can I Ask You Something? The Sex History Podcast. I'm your host, Sydney, and before we dive in, I do want to give a content warning as we will be discussing death, miscarriage, some in graphic detail, as well as mention of sexual violence. Now, if this is something you need to pass on, I fully understand, and I'll catch you on the next episode. Let's jump into today's question.
Have Americans always been so divided on abortion? What was it like back then?
That's a great question, and, well, I'll let you all decide on the answer. Now, let's get sexy. Pause! The year is 1588, Italy, November 29th. Pope Sixtus V has released Effronatum, a papal bull officially forbidding all abortions. The papal bull got rid of previous distinctions between an ensouled or animated and unanimated fetus. Ensoulment was believed to occur around 40 days after the conception of a male and about 80 for a female. Harsh in his punishment, Effronatum listed excommunication and legal charges and sentences for homicide for an intentional abortion as punishment, and those punishments extended to anybody who participated in the procedure. The papal bull also condemned practicing contraception, taking a hard stance against the use, design, and recommendation of potions meant to prevent pregnancy. Citizens and church officials alike found Effronatum to be a tad overzealous, with bishops flooding the church with questions asking for clarifications or requesting special permission to absolve violators. Before Effronatum, church doctrine had various punishments with varying severity depending on how far along the pregnancy was. Effronatum was eventually revoked in 1591 by Pope Gregory XIV, reinstating the original punishment of excommunication after an intentional abortion post-fetal animation. The legal classification of abortion as murder was also rescinded, and it stayed that way until 1869, when the Catholic Church, under Pope Pius IX, declared all abortion murder in his papal bull, and it's been this way since. And before we dive into other 19th century abortion practices and attitudes, I'd like to take a moment to dive into the meaning that abortion held within indigenous groups, with focus on Crow women and among enslaved women. What was their relationship with abortion? How did they gather agency from this practice? For the Crow tribe, the stars are especially sacred. According to Crow cosmology, the stars provided people with critical life knowledge, and the seven sacred brothers residing in the Big Dipper constellation introduced massage techniques and kneading methods for the stomach to terminate pregnancies, among other things. The technique was performed by a skilled older woman. The Crow, an indigenous Montana tribe that was spread around the Dakotas and Wyoming previously, had established deep social and cultural connections to native plants in their reproductive practices. Crow women also had strong sexual and reproductive autonomy, which included the freedom to choose to terminate a pregnancy, for which there would be more than a couple reasons, like a particularly brutal winter, constant travel, or the mother's health, since birthing a strong, healthy infant with high likelihood of survival was something that the mother needed to be confident in, though this would shift with land theft and the establishment of reservations. Crow women birthed and labored in isolated female-only spaces among older women, and these elders were deeply knowledgeable of women's health and abortifacients. It's likely that Crow women used beetroot, but generally, native women in the plains region used medicinal herbs like juniper, horsetail, and calamus as abortifacients. Now, after the establishment of reservations, government employees issued reports lamenting abortion practices at Crow and other reservations in Montana. The reports perpetuated stereotypes of sexual promiscuity, justified their own colonial presence, and diverted blame from these same colonial policies and behaviors to women's sexual behavior, while barely mentioning the material conditions that likely influenced indigenous women's reproductive decisions. The Crow Agency, started in 1868, acted as a sort of headquarters for federal interaction with the Crow tribe. One government agent, Samuel G. Reynolds, blamed the Crow's land situations on Crow women's ability to terminate should they choose, and not on the policies that he himself had implicated, like asking the government doctor Walter Q.G. Tucker in 1903 to dedicate time to spy on female patients and their pregnancies. In a 1905 letter from Reynolds to the commissioner, it revealed that not only had Tucker been surveilling these women, but he had spent several months engaged in detective work, relying on info relayed by, quote, policemen, Indian judges, Indian employees, and his personal friends throughout the tribe, end quote. Assigning himself the task of discovering all pregnancies on the reservation and paying the pregnant woman and her husband a visit to make a case for the importance of raising babies. Which is funny, considering that those very same babies would end up getting snatched away from their families and their homes, their land. But let me not get ahead of myself. But that same year, on June 30th, Reynolds wrote to Commissioner Francis Loop, with whom he had regularly connected with, quote, I beg the honor to say that the frequent cases of abortion practiced among these Indians during my time as agent has been a matter I have given much thought and energy towards stopping, end quote. But Reynolds didn't stop there. He also reported that in regular appeals to Crow men in council meetings or private conversations, he represented reproduction and land politics as really intertwined, taking advantage of these men's anxieties around land possession. Reynolds, you know, took the regular route of blaming women and argued that Crow women getting abortions would lead to fewer Crows to receive land allotments, resulting in less land for the tribe as well as for any given families. Into the 1930s, Native women had limited birth control options. Some Crow and other Native women continued to use herbs as contraception, but Crows reported significant decreases in abortions at the end of the decade due to fears of legal consequences. Now, enslaved Black women had similar experiences with white intervention over their reproduction, but obviously there are some differences that we'll get into. Now, the success of this country is deeply intertwined with Black women's reproduction. Enslavers depended on women's ability to bear children and increase the slave population. A plantation, an industry, an entire economy built on the free labor of enslaved people continued to not only thrive, but grow, with Black women's reproductive abilities at the center of it. And these women knew this, and that can be seen in their acts of resistance and attempts at reclaiming some form of autonomy, like avoiding sex, infanticide or maternal filicide, and abortion were all ways enslaved women tried to resist their circumstances and exercise control over when or if they birthed more enslaved children, especially if the mother was expecting a daughter, understanding the life of sexual violence that would follow that child's life should they be born. Look at the case of Margaret Garner, who on the night of January 27, 1856, 8 slaves, 6 of whom were Margaret, her husband Robert, and their 4 children, Tom, Celia, Sam, and Mary, attempted to flee their Boone County, Kentucky plantation. Margaret mainly cared for the children of her enslaver and accompanied him to Cincinnati numerous times. So when the group escaped, they fled for the Ohio River and crossed it into the free state of Ohio, continuing to Cincinnati towards the home of their freed relatives, the Kites. They got there before daybreak and had an early breakfast. Margaret's cousin Elijah left to get help from Levi Coffin, who told Elijah to get the Garners out as soon as possible and move them to Mill Creek, where a settlement of other free Black people lived, until Coffin could make arrangements to move the family further on the Underground Railroad. But Elijah was too late, as deputy marshals and police were already at the home. And just as the cops were about to enter the house, Margaret tried to kill her children, only succeeding in murdering her 2-year-old daughter, Mary, by the time the police found her. Margaret and the rest of the family were taken into custody, and instead of being released back into the supervision of the slave master, they were held and tried. The judge eventually ruled to have Margaret return to Kentucky, but once Ohio police received a warrant to put Margaret on trial for first-degree murder, they couldn't find her. Margaret's enslavers shuffled her between cities in the state to avoid having her formally arrested. And while they did get close in Louisville, they arrived too late as she was put on a boat to Arkansas. Here it's reported that she jumped from the boat while holding her child, and when she surfaced, held by some of the sailors, the child had drowned. Robert, her husband, stated in an interview after her death that Margaret never tried to harm her children again, but that she often expressed that it would be better for them to be put out of the world than live in slavery. She died still enslaved in Mississippi in 1858 of typhoid fever. Infanticide was incredibly rare. It still was reacted to quite negatively by white people who used these cases to categorize black women as monstrous and violent mothers. Another tool dehumanizing black women and further reinforcing the idea of civilizing enslaved and non-white people. Orally exchanging and passing down medicinal and herbal knowledge brought with them from Africa by the generation was a way for enslaved black women to prevent pregnancy or induce a miscarriage. But these treatments were also used for simple things like period regulation and birthing assistance. They chewed cotton root to prevent pregnancy and they used it as an abortifacient. They also took calomel and turpentine. Just as Luli says, quote, "In them days, the turpentine was strong and 10 or 12 drops would miscarry you. But the makers found out what it was used for and they changed the way of making turpentine. They ain't no good no more," end quote. Luli, who was a formerly enslaved woman in Texas, had also said, quote, "I have known two of women who got pregnant and didn't want the baby and unfixed themselves by taking calomel and turpentine," end quote. But when knowledge of those specific abortifacients reached the enslaver, the women then switched to using indigo. Black women, freed and enslaved alike, used their knowledge to also terminate unwanted pregnancies with men that they didn't like, such as the case with Mary Gaffney, who was forced to marry a man that she hated. She used her knowledge of local flora to prevent pregnancy. She said, quote, "I never did have any slaves to grow, and master, he wondered what was the matter. I tell you, son, I kept cotton roots and chewed them all the time, but I was careful not to let master know or catch me," end quote. Aloe and the leaves of young okra were also known abortifacients. But abortion was so common among enslaved women that other slaves expressed concern about the continuation of the race. This is shown by Anna Lee, who was an informant of the Works Project Administration, who described the widespread use of chewing cotton root to prevent pregnancy. Quote, "If slavery had lasted much longer, there would not have been many slaves left. We had done quit breeding," end quote. But outside of that, just like with the Catholics, abortion was a socially accepted practice, to a point, and usually performed by midwives who held on to their role well into the 20th century, but they'd soon find themselves politicized and under attack. Attitudes on abortion had already begun to shift in the late 19th century thanks to Victorian values. Changing social and class dynamics had Americans viewing abortion as a wealthy white woman thing. They were starting families later, limiting family size, taking advantage of increased independence, and exercising their right to make choices for themselves. And that's threatening to a man who thinks women are best pregnant and kept in the kitchen. Not to mention that more of these women were spending a lot of their time volunteering, i.e., less time at home. But the anti-abortion crusade was started not by religious groups or even individuals fighting on a moral, political foundation. It was started by ambitious male physicians in the 1860s, and with their and others' efforts, abortion was fully banned across the country by 1910. The campaign painted women who got abortions as unnatural, as selfish, as people undermining the natural order of things and their patriotic and godly role of being a wife and mother. You know, propaganda that people can really get behind. Physicians in the anti-abortion movement labeled midwives as abnormal, undermining their expertise and profession while boosting their own credibility and authority, while also utilizing the media to further strengthen their movement. Midwifery, a mostly female profession, was a role largely held by black women who made up half of the people who provided reproductive health care, the other being made up of white and indigenous women. So you can see how that would be threatening to white men fresh out of medical school entering a new field of gynecology and labor and delivery. GL&D needed credibility, and what better way to do that than throw women under the bus? These fresh gynecologists within the anti-abortion movement claim that midwives offered a degraded means of care in obstetrics, a practice that they were particularly trained for. Training that was developed from the experimentation and torture of enslaved black women by Dr. Marion Sims, who developed medical tools that we continue to use today, actually. Black midwives were painted as unhygienic, barbaric, dangerous, unprofessional, ineffective. Listen to how Dr. Joseph DeLee, an obstetrician and vehement midwife hater, speaks on the matter in his 1916 speech, Progress Toward Ideal Obstetrics. Quote, "The midwife is a relic of barbarism. In civilized countries, the midwife is wrong, has always been wrong. The midwife has been a drag on the progress of the science and art of obstetrics. Her existence stunts the one and degrades the other. For many centuries, she perverted obstetrics from attaining any standing at all among the science of medicine, even after midwifery was practiced by some of the most brilliant men in the profession. Such practice was held opprobrious and degraded." End quote. He also said in that same speech, quote, "I feel certain that if every midwife in America were to vanish today, before the weekend, every woman in the United States would be cared for, and cared for much better than she is today." But can't you just train them instead of pushing midwives out of a job? You'd think, but DeLee, outside of his obvious rallying against the existence of midwives, argued that providing proper training and medical education to current midwives would do simply no good. This anti-midwife sentiment helped cement the anti-abortion movement that had taken shape decades prior around the mid-19th century with help of the American Medical Association, who prohibited membership from any women or black people, and the Catholic Church. The first statutes governing abortion in the U.S. were poison control measures, like the 1827 Illinois law against the provision of abortifacients, which read, "Every person who shall willfully and maliciously administer or cause to be administered to or taken by any person, any poison or other noxious or destructive substance or liquid with an intention to cause the death of such person or to procure the miscarriage of any woman then being with child and shall thereof be duly convicted shall be imprisoned for a term not exceeding 3 punishment years and be fined in a sum not exceeding $1,000. But as you can hear in the wording, the law really only seems to crack down on the commercialization of abortifacients, which was a booming industry by the 1840s, and not people taking them. Sure, selling it was illegal, but nothing's mentioned about growing abortifacients at home or foraging for them, which you could argue was probably a safer option. These laws were on the books, but the industry still flourished, with some of the sellers posting ads in the paper. One prominent abortion provider who advertised herself as a female physician was Madame Restelle, born Anne Trow and later Loman through marriage in the summer of 1812 in England. She stayed in business for nearly 4 decades, and she started in New York in the late 1830s, her first ad running in 1839, reading, "To married women, is it not but too well known that the families of the married often increase beyond what the happiness of those who give them birth would dictate? Is it moral for parents to increase their families, regardless of consequences to themselves or the well-being of their offspring, when a simple, easy, healthy, and certain remedy is within our control?" The advertiser, feeling the importance of this subject and estimating the vast benefit resulting to thousands by the adoption of means prescribed by her, has opened an office where married females can obtain the desired information. By the mid-1840s, she had expanded her business to Boston and Philly, along with having a crew of traveling agents selling Restelle's female monthly pills. Madame Restelle did eventually get caught up with the law in 1841 after the death of Maria Purdy in 1840. Purdy, while on her deathbed, dying from what she believed to be a botched surgical abortion, though it was actually tuberculosis, had told her husband of her abortion attempt. She had a 10-month-old at home and couldn't handle another child, so she'd gone to Restelle, who sold her a yellow vial for $1. She took one dose that day and two more the next, but stopped after becoming anxious about the effects of the yellow medicine, which she had taken to a doctor who identified it as tansy and turpentine, known abortifacients. Purdy returned to Rustell, who told her an operation could be done for $20. Purdy paid with a pawn ticket for jewelry, and Rustell took Purdy to a back room where a man examined her, pressing his hand against her abdomen and determining that she was only 3 months along. Whether she was further, Purdy didn't specify. The surgical abortion was performed, and convinced that her symptoms were the result of the abortion, she found herself in the hospital. Her husband went to the police, and Rustell was arrested and charged with two counts of attempting to produce an abortion on June 2nd and July 22nd of 1840. She was found guilty, but appealed and was found not guilty the second time due to Purdy's confession being inadmissible. One person in the editorial of the publication of Rustell's trial referred to her as a monster in human shape, celebrating her guilty verdict, stating, "Rustell's been convicted of one of the most hellish acts ever perpetrated in a Christian land." But gender, racial, and class anxieties in the country also pushed anti-abortion sentiment, as married middle and upper-class white women were the main group of people getting abortions, and increased visibility of them doing so also didn't help. Support for abortion restrictions were bolstered by the white husbands of these women due to the alarming growing non-white population. This, and a strengthening wave of feminism, challenging long-standing gender norms, a declining birth rate, and these population changes led to strong anxiety among wealthy American men. Horatio Storer, who was a leader of the medical anti-abortion movement, had also previously urged white women to spread their loins across the nation and envision that spread of civilization west and south by those very same native-born white babies. He said, quote, "All the fruitfulness of the present generation, taxed to its utmost, can hardly fill the gaps in our population that have of late been made by disease and the sword. While the great territories of the far west, just opening to civilization, and the fertile savannas of the south, now disenthralled and first made habitable by freemen, offer homes for countless millions yet unborn. Shall they be filled by our own children or by those of aliens? This is a question that our own women must answer. Upon their loins depends the future destiny of the nation." Now, feminists at the time were fighting for women to be allowed in the professional medical field as physicians, while also expressing their own frustration over male sexual domination and promiscuity. Anti-abortionists painted the practice and the people who provided the service as giving a cop-out to those dirty little sluts. You know, because women who have sex with more than one person before marriage need to be punished. There need to be consequences. Letting people have an abortion defiles the sanctity of marriage and encourages prostitution. The anti-abortion movement utilized sexual politics in order to further their goal. If you can successfully paint women who get an abortion as immoral, unwomanly, and unpatriotic, you can garner more support for outlawing the practice. And with Storer at the helm of this movement, they worked to discredit and destroy the concept of quickening, or first movement of the fetus. And that really undermines someone's pregnancy experience, and it makes them rely on medical opinion. Storer said, "Quickening is in fact but a sensation." He argued that the quickening wasn't reliable because it didn't happen at a standard point. Storer and his coalition actively worked to remove the distinction between earlier and later stages of pregnancy, which went against women's perception of conception as the blocking of menstruation earlier in the century and colonial period. And blocked menstruation required medical attention. It indicated an imbalance in the body, and reinstating that balance by bringing back your flow was important. A visible, violent physical response to treatment was viewed as a step in the right direction to restoring that flow. So working to remove that was stripping away something that was culturally and socially understood as a blocking of menstruation and restoring the flow prior to quickening. And all of that was relabeled as abortion altogether. Anti-abortion laws passed across the country between 1860 and 1880, and abortions could be criminalized at any stage. Women who got abortions would be punished if caught, and this would affect women of all backgrounds, though some more than others. Anti-abortion laws were also bolstered by the 1873 Comstock Law, which banned mailing abortifacients and birth control, along with other obscene material, and federal obscenity laws. All thanks to Anthony Comstock. Fuck that guy. God. He sucked. Anyways. And again, the campaign was partly successful because they appealed and took advantage of the fears and anxieties of WASP men who were scared about losing political power to women, Catholics, and immigrants. What did Jasmine Masters say? Nothing new, nothing changed. So as you can see, the campaign was firing on all cylinders, and it worked. They won. Post-illegalization and criminalization, it didn't take long to see the effects of these laws. Though some did have exceptions, like Illinois, who listed an exception in their 1867 criminal abortion law that allowed doctors to perform an abortion should it save the woman's life. This was called a therapeutic abortion. As stated by Dr. Charles B. Reed, who was defending therapeutic abortion after listening to a Catholic priest speak against it at a 1904 symposium on abortion in Chicago, the advance of moral feeling, the opinion has developed that where the lives of both mother and child are imperiled and one can be saved, the child should be sacrificed, since the value of the mother to the state is far greater than that of the unborn babe. Therapeutic abortions were also being used for other reasons, like eugenics, of course, though it was officially forbidden. A doctor in 1902 asked the medical journal of the AMA whether it was justifiable to perform a therapeutic abortion in the case of a woman being mentally unsound. He was certain, quote, the child would be a degenerate, end quote. JAMA, or JAMA, responded, it would be criminal. That's it. That's literally all they said. A different doctor wrote to JAMA 2 weeks later and suggested that some doctors disagreed with JAMA's response, saying, tens of thousands of intelligent people in and outside of the medical profession who join me in asking you why it would be a crime. And JAMA kept it succinct and concise and said, because the laws make no exceptions for such conditions. Now, around the turn of the 19th century, the most common physical or disease indications accepted by physicians for a therapeutic abortion was excessive vomiting and nausea, or hyperemesis gravidarum. This condition was an easy symptom to replicate, and some women learned to mimic it to get a therapeutic abortion, which led to seasoned physicians to warn medical students and colleagues to distrust female patients seeking a therapeutic abortion, as shown by the very same DeLee in his 1916 textbook, where he stated, a word of warning, let the inexperienced physician beware of simulated disease. A woman will read up on some disease which she knows sometimes gives the indication for abortion and will try to impress the doctor that she is deathly ill. Granted, this didn't last long since a cure was found for the excessive vomiting by 1925, and there were different treatments available before that. Physicians also asked about being able to perform therapeutic abortions in cases of rape. One asked if an abortion could be justified in the case of a 16-year-old girl of, quote, unquestionable reputation, who had been drugged and raped, but JAMA said no. JAMA really encouraged an air of distrust between physician and patient. They'd expressed doubt on the validity of women's reports of rape for a therapeutic abortion. The editor of JAMA posed to the querying doctor, remember, pregnancy is rare after real rape in that the fright may easily cause suppression of menstruation and other subjective symptoms. JAMA also stated, the enormity of the crime of rape does not justify murder. Now, some women did have the ability to leverage some type of power over physicians in order to receive an abortion. Wealthy women who had the responsibility of selecting private doctors for the family were able to use that leverage because these relationships would last for decades, so it was a steady source of income for these doctors. That provided a kind of power to apply pressure on the family doctor to provide an abortion. An 1888 expose, debates about therapeutic abortion, and police reports all show a general willingness of most physicians to help women obtain an abortion, Some would agree to perform it themselves, while most assisted in helping a patient find someone who would or could. Though that same expose did conveniently list abortionists, even though it had like the complete opposite goal. In 1900, Dr. Denslow Lewis, who was a professor and president of attending staff of Cook County Hospital, noted that wealthy citizens and the physicians that they hired regarded abortion as a matter of routine. And he also spoke about losing the patronage of well-known society women because he would refuse to provide abortions for them. 4 years later, Dr. Rudolph Holmes noted that, quote, daily papers, magazines, and even so-called religious papers are most fruitful means for producing abortion, end quote. Ads for abortive care were alive and well, just listed under different terms like selling abortive patients as a lady's safe remedy, or midwives and doctors advertising themselves as specialists in the disease of women, just like vibrators. But that's another episode. But how was law enforcement dealing with this? What were the consequences of going the illegal route, per se? Well, between 1902 and 1934, the state's attorney office in Chicago only prosecuted a few people each year and never more than one or two convictions. Annually, there were at least 10 arrests after 1905, which increased to 25 or 26 during the 1910s and 20s, and then it jumped to nearly 40 a year in the early 30s. And this, well, the USPS, like the USPS, they were performing national raids on people suspected of using the mail to sell contraception, abortive instruments, and abortion services. And this peaked in 1912. Police investigations were also usually coercive, employing shame and fear tactics to pressure women into confessing. This is shown in the case of Lithuanian immigrant Karolina Petrovaitis in Chicago of March 1916. She was experiencing severe pain after having an abortion. She went to a Dr. Kahn who asked her, "Who did it for you?" He pressured her into revealing the abortionist, saying, "If you won't tell me what was done to you, I can't handle your case." Kahn then called an ambulance and told the attending physician what happened, suggesting that he speak to the coroner's office. Three cops arrived later to question Karolina, who is still in excruciating pain. After receiving physician approval, Sergeant William E. O'Connor had instructed an intern to tell her she's gonna die. O'Connor and another officer stood with the intern at Petrovaitis' bedside as the intern did as they were told. She started to cry. The police collected Karolina's dying declaration, naming the midwife, location, time, price, and instruments used in the procedure. The third officer found the midwife and wrote another dying statement for Petrovaitis to confirm the midwife's identity. She laid there crying, in pain, and throwing up as the officer read the statement back to her. Karolina died, leaving two small children and her husband behind. But this case isn't unique. Dying declarations became foundational in investigations. It was the main way that the state prosecuted abortionists. Between 1901 and 1919, the Cook County coroner investigated over 60 abortion deaths a year. 18 in 1903 had jumped to 103 death investigations in 1917. Though not all were criminal, some accidental, some self-induced, other spontaneous or natural. Media attention on abortion deaths also benefited law enforcement because it served as a warning to others. Straying from your feminine duty in marriage and motherhood would get you public humiliation and shaming. Most abortion investigations involved poor working immigrant or first-generation women. Poor women usually opted to self-induce abortions because they couldn't afford the exorbitant prices associated with visiting an abortionist. Most times, self-induced abortions involved cheap and dangerous methods, and this, coupled with the fact that poor women are more likely to delay medical treatment should complications occur, meant that they'd be at the hospital in a severe state, making them more likely to attract legal attention. Should an unmarried woman die from an abortion, the boyfriend or lover would be arrested, jailed, interrogated, and rarely prosecuted. That was the case for Bob Berry in 1931. His girlfriend, Alma Bromps, had died from an abortion. He was taken to identify her body after a day in jail and was promptly questioned after. He was jailed for at least a week and eventually became a witness against the abortionist accused of causing her death. Unmarried men involved in abortion-related deaths were usually jailed for a night, then questioned, but could spend several nights or even weeks in jail if they couldn't afford bail, though the same cannot be said for married men. As you can imagine, with abortion illegal and midwives pushed underground, getting an abortion was extremely difficult. Not only was it hard to find a physician who was willing to perform an abortion, there was such limited availability that prices skyrocketed and the procedure was more dangerous. Prices varied between $200 and $500 in 1955, but it depended on the abortionist. Poor Black and Latina women were dealt the hardest blow due to the illegalization of abortion, and this became particularly apparent in the 1960s. Abortions in the 50s and 60s were intensely secretive. A woman would be blindfolded, then taken to a different location to then have the procedure. Demand for abortions likely increased due to women's increased responsibilities in the workforce and growing college enrollment, which led to a stronger need for reproductive control. Expecting mothers at colleges faced discrimination and in the workplace, which was another reason for someone to seek an abortion. Birth control was near impossible to get, thanks to Comstock, so sex in the mid-century was pretty risky to do. Physicians and student clinics alike refused birth control and contraception to unmarried students. The University of Illinois Chicago literally required proof of marriage before providing any sort of birth control. So if you were unmarried and you were having sex, you had to rely on the pull-out method. Crazy. Just like in the 19th century, the business of abortion attracted many people, too many of which had bad intentions or lacked the proper knowledge and skill to be performing an abortion. Anyone could call themselves an abortionist, and this put countless women at risk and killed just as many. Famed Black magazine Ebony covered illegal abortions in their January 1951 issue, simply titling it "The Abortion Menace." The article included dim pictures of a woman meeting a shadowy middleman, a crowded room where the abortionist worked, police crowded around a bed where a woman had died from an abortion. Illegal abortions were performed in dirty motel rooms, unknown settings, and if the abortionist turned out to be a man, patients also faced the potential for sexual harassment or violence, often being asked to trade sex for an abortion. But what if you tried to go the legal route? What about therapeutic abortion? Well, it is a rock and a hard place. Legal or illegal abortion, women were presented with two dangerous, arduous, expensive options. Therapeutic abortion was a lengthy and expensive process. You'd need to see more than one physician to plead your case, making it more expensive. Then you'd have to have your case reviewed by the committee and possibly be interviewed before a judgment was given. You could go through all of that and still be denied an abortion. The psychiatric indications for therapeutic abortion started to gain traction in the 40s and 50s. Just as women were able to feign excessive vomiting in the 19th century, women of the 50s learned to do the same for psychiatric indications. In a study of 60 American hospitals, it was found that therapeutic abortion with psych indications accounted for nearly half of all therapeutic abortions between 1951 and 1960. It was common knowledge amongst women that you could get a therapeutic abortion if you had the right psychiatrist and said the right words, like threatening suicide, having intense emotional distress, you know. The Mount Sinai Therapeutic Abortion Committee accepted psychiatric indications only if suicide was threatened. Dr. Alan Guttmacher stated, "The law says that one may abort to save the life of the mother. Therefore, we insist that suicidal intent must be present in the psychiatric patient in order to validate abortion." End quote. The head of a Baltimore hospital's therapeutic abortion committee recalled how so many women threatened suicide that the claim started to be ignored. The head of a Baltimore hospital's therapeutic abortion recalled how so many women threatened suicide that the claim started to be ignored. They also referred to a story of a teen who had attempted suicide after finding out that her therapeutic abortion request had been denied. Her case was reconsidered, but the committee ultimately decided to commit her through the pregnancy to save herself. This didn't stop her, and she continued to try to kill herself until the case was opened a second time and the abortion was granted. Unmarried college students greatly relied on psychiatric indications for therapeutic abortions. According to a study of affiliated hospitals of the State University of New York, Buffalo, unmarried women went from making up 7% of therapeutic abortions in the 40s to 41% in the early 60s, with nearly all having the abortion for psychiatric reasons, 94% to married women's 48%. Some doctors saw therapeutic abortion as a way to prevent future troubled children. A psychiatrist in 1955 stated, "Most psychiatrists recognize that the woman who states she does not wish to have a baby is unlikely to be a good mother, and in the end, we may have several sick children as a result." Not everyone approved of psychiatric indications, like Dr. Sidney Bolter, who spoke of psychiatrists falling victim to women, you guessed it, shirking their womanly responsibilities. Yep. He stated, "We know that women's main role here on earth is to conceive, deliver, and raise children. The psychiatrist has become the unwitting accomplice." October 1962, that's when he said this. But don't let the quotes and statistics fool you. Hospital abortion committees caused a drop in the number of therapeutic abortions, and that was intentional. Hospitals boasted about their success reducing therapeutic abortion numbers since committees were formed. In fact, there were two studies of abortion trends in New York that showed that by the early 60s, the number of therapeutic abortions performed in the city was less than half of what it was two decades prior, about 710 in the 40s, and less to 300 by the early 60s. Mind you, between 1943 and 1962, white women in New York accounted for over 91% of therapeutic abortions. So this is really highlighting the difficulty and lack of access that black women and other women of color experienced due to racial and economic discrimination. There was a decline in the number of therapeutic abortions between 1951 and 1962, and it was highest amongst Puerto Rican women. And I'm sure you can guess which group it was lowest in. It's also important to note that the majority of therapeutic abortions were performed on private paying patients, who were mainly white. The class disparity was noted by Dr. Robert E. Hall of Columbia University. He found that private paying patients received four times as many therapeutic abortions as non-paying ward patients at Sloan Hospital. Only one of the private patients wasn't white. Ward patients presented more racial and ethnic diversity, with black, Asian, and white people seeking treatment. Dr. Hall also conducted a survey of major hospitals across the country and found the practices at Sloan Hospital wasn't unique at all. He said, "The overall frequency of therapeutic abortions at 60 outstanding American hospitals is 3.6 times higher on their private services than on their ward services." Municipal hospitals that mainly catered to low-income patients performed therapeutic abortions the least. And though middle-class women had the means to pay for a psychiatric consultation to have a therapeutic abortion, they also had the advantage of being in the same class and racial group as the psychiatrist. The majority had abortions in the same manner as their poor counterparts, illegally. There are physicians like Dr. Milan Vujicic, Edgar Keimer, and Kenneth Edelin, who were prominent abortionists in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast, who worked to help low-income women, particularly Dr. Keimer and Dr. Edelin. Vujicic, described as operating an abortion mill in one 1971 article, was a Serbian immigrant who operated in D.C. and Maryland. He performed thousands of abortions in the later half of the 1900s, though he never served time, despite his 16 arrests. The closest he got was in 1969, when he was sentenced to a year in jail and fined $5,000. On the verdict, he said, "I feel the law is an unworkable law, limiting the activities of a physician." But his clinic had several accusations of poor care and sloppiness by the 80s. In 1983, he was sued by the family of a patient who died after he gave her an abortion and agreed to pay the family $150,000. That same year, Baltimore Magazine, the Afro-American, reported that Vuich's clinic had 24 health violations. The clinic, with its accusations of anesthesia mismanagement, dirty supplies, rusted instruments, absent RNs, incomplete records, and administering incorrect medication dosage, was eventually forced to close the following year on December 21, 1984. Ed Kiemer, who was a Black HBCU graduate, mainly operated in Detroit. He, along with Edlin, mainly helped poor Black women. Kiemer, labeled as an abortion ringleader by the Daily Defender in 1958, was an ardent abortion rights advocate. He was motivated to provide illegal abortions because of the economic discrimination and the danger low- and middle-income women faced. His goal was to challenge Michigan law, hoping for clearly defined abortion laws to allow easier access to abortions regardless of financial status. He also faced frequent brushes with the law, eventually being sentenced to years in jail and a $500 fine. Kenneth Edelin, a Black graduate of Columbia, who also went to the same medical school as Kiemer, was working in Boston. Like Kiemer, he mainly provided illegal abortions for low-income Black women, something he continued to do even after Roe. Most notably, he was convicted of manslaughter after giving a 17-year-old an abortion in 1973. The year-long trial was messy and extensively covered by the Boston Globe, though there were also reports of racial bias by one of the jurors, Michael Ciano. What led to his conviction was the belief that the fetus was born alive, which Edelin went on to suffocate for several minutes, something that Edelin vehemently denied. His conviction was protested with a crowd of 1,500, mostly made up of women, coming together on February 17th. Three of the jurors even reported receiving death threats. The conviction was eventually overturned on Christmas of 1976, with the court stating, Edelin had no evil frame of mind, was actuated by no criminal purpose, and committed no wanton or reckless acts. Edelin continued his work, being one of two doctors willing to provide abortions at Boston City Hospital and frequently working on weekends for free in order to help as many low-income patients as he could. But in addition to the immense difficulty to get an abortion in general and the increased dangers, poor women also faced the reality of being forcibly sterilized. The same Dr. Hall, who pointed out the class disparity in abortion accessibility, also noted the prevalence of forced sterilization, which mainly affected poor Black women and other women of color. Low-income patients who received therapeutic abortions were sterilized twice as often as private ones. Forced sterilization was a highlight issue among Black and Indigenous activists in the 70s, but the issue was already apparent decades prior. Hospitals would utilize coercive practices like offering a therapeutic abortion in exchange for sterilization, and this practice also worked to keep their therapeutic abortion stats low. Physicians shifted their perspective to population control when it came to poor and Black, Indigenous, and other women of color. They thought these women were just having too many damn kids, and it was their job to prevent that from happening. But for more affluent white women, well, they shouldn't be shirking their childbearing responsibilities anyways. Kipling really must have had an eight ball when he wrote The White Man's Burden, because it just keeps repeating. Indigenous women only had the Indian Health Service, which was founded in 1955 and run by the Department of Health. That was their only source for health care. And the IHS, which is known for poor care and severe underfunding, prevented access to abortion and forcibly sterilized the women who came to them for help. Back in 1939, Chicago doctors reported that when they found therapeutic abortion necessary, they also preferred to sterilize the patient at the same time so they could prevent having to perform more in the future. 67% of women who had a therapeutic abortion at the Chicago Lying-In Hospital were sterilized at the same time in an 8-year period. The lack of accessibility and prohibitive cost to have an abortion, legal or not, pushed poor women to take matters into their own hands, which often included douching with soap or bleach, and the method was often fatal. Doctors at the same hospital reported receiving young women who had taken mystery pills or had been injected with lye in order to induce an abortion. Some women opted for instruments commonly found at home, like a coat hanger. One woman spoke of taking ergotrate, then castor oil, then squatting into scalding hot water and drinking Everclear. and it didn't work. So she hammered her stomach with a meat tenderizer, and that didn't work either. So she went to an illegal abortionist. Poor women also went for vaginal suppositories, which experienced a boom in sales in the early 50s. Those pills often caused vaginal burns. There was the case of a 29-year-old black woman presenting to Cook County Hospital, extremely pale, cold, and sweating profusely. Quote, her vagina was filled with clots of blood. She told the doctors that she placed a gray tablet in her vagina in order to induce an abortion. She bled for 12 hours, believing the abortion was successful. She was treated and given blood transfusion, then sent to the prenatal clinic 4 days later. She suffered vaginal injuries, and the pill failed to induce a miscarriage. Cook County Hospital went from treating little more than 1,000 patients for abortion-related complications in 1939 to nearly 5,000 by 1962. This was not unique to that county or the state either. L.A. County recorded over 2,000 cases a year in the mid-50s. D.C. General Septic Abortion Ward was also at capacity with 15 to 20 extremely ill patients inside. New York City saw increasing numbers of women die. In the 11-year period between 1951 and 1962, abortion-related deaths nearly doubled from 27 a year to 51. This isn't due to population increases, as it was still doubled when standardized to per 1,000 live births. The number of abortion-related deaths of women of color doubled in the same period, going from an average of 19 deaths a year to 41, compared to the 10 a year of white women in the early 60s. Risk of death increased with race and class, with black women dying four times as often as white women as a result of abortion. Abortion deaths accounted for nearly half of maternal deaths of black and other women of color, compared to the one-fourth of maternal deaths of white women. Even as childbirth became safer, abortion-related deaths kept climbing. At the end of the 20s, abortion-related deaths made up 14% of maternal mortality. It rose to 42.1% of total maternal mortality in New York City by the early 60s. City public health officials let everyone know that the growing number of abortion-related deaths were black and Puerto Rican women. Something needed to change. The abortion rights movement had its first stirrings in the mid-50s. And just as the anti-abortion started with a ragtag group of physicians and friends, so too did the abortion rights movement take its first steps. In the mid-50s, a small group of physicians and public health workers started the earliest efforts for abortion reform. Doctors were being prevented from providing abortions, and the growing death toll resulting from its illegal status pushed for demands for the laws to change. Psychiatrists, existing as a new liberal wing of medicine, being among the first within the field to openly question things, usually sympathizing with the emotional distress of the women that came to them. Arthur J. Mandy, a psychiatrist and gynecologist at Johns Hopkins University, was among them. He criticized the therapeutic abortion system and said it was discriminatory and chaotic, particularly the committee system, referring to it as a pathetically complicated mess, a hodgepodge of confusion, distortion, and duplicity. Lack of clear standards on therapeutic abortion indications made physicians anxious. This sentiment is echoed by Dr. Guttmacher, who instituted therapeutic abortion committees at two hospitals and remarked that those who perform therapeutic abortions always had the, quote, haunting feeling that our acts are half illegal, end quote. Then in 1955, a small, unpublicized national conference organized by Planned Parenthood took place. Consisting of public health and medical professionals, the conference served as a safe space to openly air their grievances. The attendees worked on a joint statement calling for change in abortion law, and a majority of them signed. The statement read, "Present laws and mores have not served to control the practice of illegal abortion. To keep on the books, unchallenged, laws that do not receive public sanction and observance is of questionable service to our society." Basically, strictly interpreting therapeutic abortion laws would make most therapeutic abortions illegal. The only opposition at the meeting came from a Catholic attorney and priest. These physicians advocated for the laws to allow doctors greater legal wiggle room to recommend therapeutic abortion for psychiatric, humanitarian, and eugenic indications. Yeah. That conference was a first for such elite doctors and professionals to openly advocate for reform, though the advocacy was more for legally covering their ass than for pushing for someone to make that decision themselves. Planned Parenthood did advocate for birth control access as well, but more as a form of family planning and, again, not a personal decision or female agency. Then, 4 years after the conference in 1959, the American Law Institute proposed a model law on abortion. The legal scholar who presented the proposal stated, quote, "The abortion law is out of step with the morals of a substantial, responsible group," end quote. The model law expanded on the legal exception for therapeutic abortions in line with physicians' desires, allowing doctors to perform an abortion for physical and mental health, fetal defect, or if a pregnancy was a result of rape or incest. Now, you may be wondering, did allowing an abortion simply because someone wanted one come up? It certainly did, and it was quickly disregarded. In the ALI's eyes, quote, "It would not be sensible to propose a general abortion at will statute in this country." So they made sure not to challenge any norms around sex and gender, and the thought of openly saying someone pregnant and unmarried should be allowed to have an abortion was swiftly squashed. Now, the hope with the model law was that physicians would have less anxiety about performing a therapeutic abortion, thus making them more available. But not everyone was on board with this proposal, of course. Eugene Quay, an Illinois lawyer, wanted to keep abortion illegal, like really bad. In 1960 and 1961, he published quite the treatise in the Georgetown Law Journal, where he made sure to warn Catholic attorneys of the burgeoning legal movement to reform abortion law and personally provided arguments against ALI's model law. 85% of New York obstetricians and gynecologists supported the model law. Then in 1968, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists approved the liberalization of abortion laws. The American Public Health Association were also advocating for public funding of abortion to ensure its availability to everyone. Now, it took a decade, but a small handful of states in 1967, California, Colorado, and North Carolina, had passed the model law. Illinois voted against it that same year and the next one, even though the state and Chicago bar associations had been advocating for abortion legalization in cases of rape or incest. By 1970, 12 other states passed abortion reform based on the ALI model. That same year, New York legalized abortion up to 24 weeks. Similar laws were passed in Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington. Guttmacher, who became quite a visible national advocate for abortion reform, made it clear that his belief in abortion reform stemmed from watching so many women die because of abortion. As California reform supporters Jerome M. Comer, UCLA doctor, and Zad Levy, who was a lawyer and former prosecutor, put so well, quote, "We are confronted with a sea of heartache and confusion and the tragic wastage of more than 5,000 deaths per year. How many women must be sacrificed to needless suffering and death?" End quote. So, we know what the doctors were doing. What about the feminists? Well, feminists argued that abortion criminalization was fundamental in women's oppression, weaponizing the law and medical institutions to make decisions about a woman's own reproduction strips her of her own judgment, agency, and limits her freedom. There were actionable steps being taken on the abortion rights front by feminist organizations in the early 60s, though. I'm going to highlight two. The Society for Humane Abortion in San Francisco and Jane in Chicago, both having established underground abortion networks. The SHA was founded by Patricia McGinnis, who worked as a medical technician in San Francisco in 1961. She was critical of ALI's model law and felt that reform wouldn't benefit most women seeking to have an abortion. Similar to her peers in the medical field, SHA criticized the abortion committee structure, saying, quote, "A woman's choice to have an abortion should not be frustrated and delayed by the complex machinery of legislated abortion committees which sit in judgment of the woman. A decision to obtain an abortion should be treated just as any other surgical procedure, as a private matter between patient and her physician." End quote. Their position on the issue was clear. The termination of a pregnancy is a decision which the person or family involved should be free to make as their own religious beliefs, values, emotions, and circumstances may dictate. This radicalized the discourse. McGinnis created another organization in the mid-60s that provided information to women in San Francisco on where to get an abortion. They ran classes, handed out leaflets listing abortionists outside of the country in Sweden, Japan, and Mexico, and regulated the population of illegal abortionists in the city. By the end of the decade, SHA reported sending 12,000 women outside the country to obtain an abortion. Jane, on the other side of the country in Chicago, had more collaborative roots. It started in 1965 with Heather Booth, who was a student activist at UChicago, when she had agreed to find a doctor to provide an abortion for the sister of her male friend. Over the years, Booth ended up giving out the name of the abortionist so often that she got overwhelmed by the demand and sought out other women, thus setting the foundation to build a network. In 1967, the service was created in Hyde Park by a coalition of like-minded women by Booth, made up of other University of Chicago students and homemakers in the area. The service was the part of the network that provided abortions, no questions asked. Though Jane members started out sending women to abortionists, they didn't like that not all of them were actual physicians, so they decided to learn how to perform the procedure themselves. The prevalence of the group lowered prices and improved quality of procedure, essentially creating a feminist healthcare system in the Chicago underground. They negotiated prices with abortionists and also set up a mutual aid fund. There was also a coalition called the Chicago Women's Liberation Union, and that group advertised abortion services through their underground newspaper, women's liberation journals, and school papers. This is how the process worked. A woman calls the union about having an abortion. The union gives her a number, tells her to leave a message asking for Jane. A Jane member returns the call, records her medical history, and sets up an appointment with a counselor who would go on to explain the process and procedure. The counselor would then tell her to go to an area called the front, which was basically a waiting room for any people accompanying the woman who was receiving an abortion. Once at the front, the service members prepared her for the procedure, took her temperature, gave her a leaflet of what to do if she experienced any complications, and administered antibiotics. She would then be taken from the front to an apartment with a carload of other women seeking the same procedure. A Jane member at the apartment then gave each woman a local anesthetic and performed the abortion while another counselor held the recipient's hand. Jane provided between 11,000 and 12,000 abortions between 1969 and 1973. This network provided abortive care to people of all backgrounds, even the wealthy, but they mainly provided care to poor women. As one service member put it, quote, about 70% were women of color, most of whom were living on subsistence wage or welfare with very poor health care, end quote. But with the sheer number of people that they helped, you can imagine that not everyone had a positive experience with Jane. A former patient complained that it took too long, that it was painful, and she felt doubtful of their skills. She disliked the fact that it was being done in an apartment and that the abortionist was wearing jeans. SHA and Jane also warned their members and patients of police investigation methods and the hospitals that voluntarily helped them. Sometimes hospitals would withhold pain medication from women unless they divulged the details of their abortion. Radical feminists of the time regarded abortion as integral to sexual and reproductive freedom due to the material importance that it held in women's lives. How can you enjoy having sex with a man if you're constantly worried about getting pregnant and it's incredibly difficult to get birth control, especially if you're unmarried? Even then, birth control wasn't 100% effective. But not every abortion's right advocate or organization did so for great reasons. Planned Parenthood promoted global population control measures, which was targeted toward poor areas and the global South. Senator Robert Packwood, a Republican from Oregon, even introduced a bill to Congress to liberalize abortion law and presented it as a solution to the population explosion in 1970. Planned Parenthood provided contraceptives to low-income women, usually serving women of color and black women. Women in these groups welcomed the birth control, but there was still an air of mistrust and pressure to accept it. Rightfully so. Black nationalists in cities saw the underlying racism and anti-blackness of population control. They considered birth control a tool of black genocide. Some took it a step further and pushed for the birth of more black babies, again weaponizing the uterus of black women. As one New York black nationalist said to Ebony, "See that sister there? She's having another baby for me. I need an army, and this is how we're going to get it." Of course, black and Latina feminists were already discussing the issue of forced sterilization and eugenics, and they rejected the idea that the path to revolution relied on a woman's role simply being to have children. As Florence Kennedy puts it, "Breeding revolutionaries is not too far removed from a cultural past where black women were encouraged to be breeding machines for their slave masters." Shirley Chisholm was another critic of the black genocide birth more revolutionaries rhetoric. She believed it was, quote, "male rhetoric for male ears," end quote. She shifted attention to the high mortality rate of illegal abortions among black and Puerto Rican women and advocated for accessible legal abortion. On another front, indigenous women were also fighting and protesting against forced sterilization, something the Native Women's Organization, WARN, or Women of All Red Nations, held as a main focus: forced sterilization with the same eugenic intent. It's estimated that in the beginning of 1970, between 25 and 42% of Native women were sterilized over a six-year period. But Jane and SHA weren't the only groups pushing for abortion rights. There were religious groups setting up their own abortion access networks and expressing support for reform, like clergymen of numerous denominations creating a national clergy abortion referral service. Students at a Chicago Women's Catholic College formed a chapter of the Women's National Abortion Action Coalition. Reverend Dr. E. Spencer Parsons, who was dean of the University of Chicago's chapel in 1966, started Chicago's Clergy Consultation Service on Problem Pregnancies. The clergy service helped 7,500 women get an abortion outside of Illinois and eventually merged with Planned Parenthood's own referral service. Nearly equal numbers of the women helped were both married and unmarried, 70% white, 23% black, 43% Catholic, and 20% low income. A 1969 poll found that most Catholics believed that abortion should be a private decision and supported repealing criminal abortion laws. There were limitations with out-of-state travel for the procedure, though, as shown with Doris B., a 26-year-old black woman who had an illegal abortion in Chicago in 1972. She felt unable to care for another child when she already had four and was struggling on welfare. She couldn't afford to travel to New York for a safer, legal one, and Doris died from septicemia due to complications. Though the model law was active in several states, it quickly became clear that the reform was ineffective in its goals and took away the interpretive room that physicians previously had. They were even more bound to the therapeutic abortion committee system. There needed to be greater legal intervention. With lawyers like Quay at the helm rallying against abortion rights and sharing legal strategies to keep it a criminal procedure, new strategies had to be developed to fight for criminal abortion laws to be repealed. Young lawyers like Sybil Freitz and Susan Grossman challenged the constitutionality of Illinois' criminal abortion laws, filing a class action suit, Doe v. Scott, in 1969. Grossman was a new attorney at the Chicago Legal Aid Bureau, and Freitz at Chicago ACLU, which is where they met. Freitz mainly worked on free speech and civil rights cases. The German immigrant felt American women had an appalling lack of ambition. Her words, and didn't identify with women's liberation movements going on in the country. Grossman was compelled to act upon hearing the California Supreme Court decision finding the state's 19th century abortion statute unconstitutional in People v. Belus, 1969. As it was noted earlier, abortion criminalization affected poor women the most, and the duo held this as a focus in the case. Doe v. Scott was constructed by speaking on the discriminatory nature of the current abortion system, the restrictive nature of therapeutic abortion policies, and the dangers women faced as consequence. The case started because two women were unable to obtain legal abortions because physicians were too anxious and fearful of being prosecuted under Illinois law. One of the women was wealthy and ended up flying to Great Britain to get their abortion, while the other was poor and forced to carry the unwanted pregnancy to term, highlighting the inequity of the law. The lawyers argued, quote, "The statute systematically discriminates against poor women, depriving them of equal access to the treatment available to women of means solely because they are poor," end quote. Their secondary argument was that women had the right to make decisions about their pregnancy. They state in their brief, "The law compels her, against her will, to continue a pregnancy. Forcing a woman to have an unwanted child forces her to risk her life, her health, and the quality of her own and her family's life." They also argued that Illinois' criminal abortion law represents an impermissible intrusion into the right to her personal integrity and is a deprivation of her personal liberty. They also spoke of women's right to self-determination, not being subject to the will of her father or husband. Griswold v. Connecticut, 1965, where the Supreme Court found that Connecticut laws against birth control violated a constitutional right to privacy and granted married couples a legal right to contraception, was also referenced in the legal duo's case. Four plaintiffs, Frederick P. Zuspin, David N. Danforth, Charles Fields, and Ralph M. Wynn, all nationally recognized physicians in the field of obstetrics and gynecology at prestigious Chicago hospitals and professors or department heads, all provided signed affidavits on restrictions on therapeutic abortions and the death and injury toll from illegal abortions. Then, in January 1971, the federal court found the Illinois law unconstitutional and highlighted the difficulties faced by reputable doctors and women's rights, the majority opinion being that the state couldn't ban early abortions performed by licensed physicians in a licensed medical facility. After the court decision, Cook County Hospital received hundreds of calls from women seeking an abortion. But the win was short-lived, as Cook County State Attorneys Edward V. Hanrahan and Dr. Bart Hefferman successfully appealed the ruling and secured an injunction, staying the lower court's ruling until the Supreme Court could rule on the Scott case. Abortion was illegal again, after 10 days. In 1970, 8 Chicago hospitals provided less than 500 therapeutic abortions, compared to the 3,000 a year performed by Jane and the near 5,000 at Cook County Hospital being cared for due to abortion complications. Nationally, it was estimated that there were 50,000 illegal abortions performed each year. Women were traveling to Hawaii, New York, and Alaska in order to have the procedure done. New York acted as a haven for women across the country, and 65% of abortions performed in New York were for women traveling from out of state. And in 1971 and 1972, 13,000 of them came from Illinois. At Illinois House Majority Leader Henry Hyde's behest, Edward Hanrahan called Reverend Spencer Parsons before a grand jury and demanded he name the abortionist he was in contact with. But Parsons refused and claimed clergy confidentiality. Then Hanrahan went to the Illinois Supreme Court in January 1972 with the case People X. Rel. Hanrahan v. White, where a suicidal pregnant teenager received a therapeutic abortion on psychiatric indication. The court ruled that the law didn't allow therapeutic abortions for suicidal behavior, closing the loophole and dealing a massive blow to the medical front of the abortion rights movement. Police also increased abortion-related arrests, focusing on activists. Jane was raided months after the Hanrahan ruling. 3 women were in the middle of having an abortion, and nearly 50 people were taken in for questioning. 7 members were arrested for abortion. Shirley Wheeler was arrested in Florida for having an abortion and convicted of manslaughter in 1971. 10 days before a 1972 Michigan referendum vote on abortion law, Dr. Keemer, his assistants, and a dozen patients were arrested and jailed. His conviction was later erased after the Wade decision. Keemer, along with other like-minded physicians, intentionally tried to be arrested as a catalyst for other cases on the constitutionality of abortion law. Then, in 1972, Supreme Court case Eisenstadt v. Baird established a legal right to contraception for single women. It all comes to a head in 1973 with the monumental Roe v. Wade Supreme Court case. The majority opinion held that abortion was a medical decision and recognized the right of physicians to practice medicine without undue interference. This case, in addition to Doe v. Bolton, where the Supreme Court declared that the therapeutic abortion committee system of the 40s and 50s was unconstitutional. Policies designed to restrict abortion access violated the rights of women to health care and of physicians to practice, though the court did reject the notion that the nation's abortion laws were discriminatory. These cases were major wins for abortion rights and access and made it much safer for everyone involved. As you can see, this country's relationship with abortion has been contentious, messy, deadly, liberal. Even groups we thought were always against it provided some leeway. Sure, definitely still sin, but you know. Something being pushed to the underground because of stigma, illegality, criminalization, safety will not be prioritized, and there will always be people waiting in the shadows to take advantage of someone else's desperation. But what do y'all think? What surprised you the most in this episode? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Were you able to make any connections? Because I know I did. Sources and a legal timeline on abortion law are linked. Thank you so much again for tuning in. Do not forget to follow on Instagram at CIAYS Podcast. I'm Sydney, and this is Can I Ask You Something? The Sex History Podcast. Until next time.